Hey, CN Evers. Welcome to this week's program, where I invited Louisa Thomas, author of two books of historical nonfiction and a writer for the New Yorker website and occasionally the magazine. I couldn't help but notice the immense praise heaped on her for her terrific biography of Louisa Adams. Get this. On the back, she has five blurbs from Joseph J. Ellis, Walter Isaacson, Stacy Schiff, John Meacham, and Meghan Marshall. Four out of the five preface their work by saying, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of fill-in-the-blank. Four out of five, 80%. If that was me, my mother would look at that and say, you couldn't have gotten five out of five Pulitzer Prize winners. I'd bring home report cards with all A's and one B, and she'd say, you couldn't get all A's. One time I got all A's, and she said, you couldn't get all A pluses. Feelings of inadequacy be damned. I'm here to showcase the world's best artists on the Creative Nonfiction Podcast and how they go about creating works of nonfiction so you can use their tools of mastery to improve your own work. And like I said a moment ago, Louisa Thomas joins me this week. She's at Louisa H. Thomas on Twitter. She recently made the big book for the best American sports writing for her piece, Serena Williams, Andy Murray, and a Political Wimbledon. In this episode, we talk about her biography, Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams, working with problematic writers, and how specifically not to be one, mercenary writing, and what she learned working under David Remnick at The New Yorker, and also how she organizes her titanic feats of research. And much, much more. So people are taking advantage of my free hour of editorial work and coaching. It's about a $50 value. So if you want in, all you have to do is leave an honest review on iTunes and have it postmarked by the end of December 2017. Send me a screenshot of your review and you'll be on your way. I'll reach out at that point. Reviews validate the podcast and increase its visibility so we can reach more CNF and people. I'm not even asking for 5-star reviews, merely honest ones, because that comes from a more authentic place. All right, enough of my stupid face. Time to hear from Louisa Thomas. Thanks for listening. Congratulations on a Best American Sports Writing nod. That's always a big thrill, I imagine.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. I'd been an honorable mention a few times before, so it was nice to get in to the pages proper.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me what that was like, you know, to be notable, so to be knocking on the door and then to finally sort of that, you know, everything kind of aligned and came together for you to like give you that, to get you into the anthology proper.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a great honor, and I was really happy about it. I can't say it was like a long-term goal I had. So it's not like something I was, you know, gunning for and focused on in any way. It's more like, you know, you try and do the best work you can, and it's really nice when it's acknowledged.
That's like a good point to underscore, that it's like it shouldn't be the end goal to make it into these types of things, but it should always be kind of the goal. And this is how I see it, to just at least be doing the type of work that typically gets anthologized, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I was not surprised by how to put this. The piece that I wrote that was selected was not a piece that I had, you know, it was a reactive piece. It wasn't a piece that I spent, months working on, obviously, because it was about something that had just happened. But in some ways, those are my favorite kinds of pieces to do, these days, because they're written from a place of, you know, spontaneous, like, thought and emotion. So, it was nice in some ways. In some ways, you always want like the things that you pour your heart and soul into for a long time to be the things that sort of stand out. But it's also nice that, when there's something that you really enjoy doing, that that's what catches people's attention. You know, that's validating in a different kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny for a piece of that nature, like it's pretty short, relatively speaking, you know, the column you did for Wimbledon, and it was, I don't know, maybe 1,000 words. I'm just looking at the page.
Yeah, I think it was about 1,200 words or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And talk about something that was just, like you said, reactive, and not, it's not the type of thing that you do like a supreme deep dive into. And then also you happen to have a guest editor in Howard Bryant, who's like a tennis nerd.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, stars aligned. And it's like, you had this great piece and the guest editor happened to be like, it just tunes his antenna to tennis. Yeah. And then, you know, it worked out beautifully.
I mean, it's the kind of piece that probably a non tennis editor wouldn't have noticed. I mean, the New Yorker does a great job of featuring stuff, so they might have come onto it just through the site. But it's not like one of those pieces that there's build up for, because it's just, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, of course. And so when you were starting out as a reporter or writer, what did those early days look like as you were looking to possibly take this type of work on as a vocation?
Well, when I started, I actually started as a fact checker for the New Yorker magazine. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was probably going to do that for a couple of years and then go to law school. And then I became the assistant to the editor there, David Remnick. And I decided that I wanted to try my hand at writing, back in those days, the New Yorker didn't really have a robust website. They didn't have their own content, original content. So really the only way to do that was actually to leave the magazine, which I did.
And where are we time-wise in that?
So this is like 2007.
Okay.
So I went and wrote a book about Four Brothers in World War I and started writing a lot of book reviews. That was actually really my start. It was not like as a reporter. I mean, I did a little bit of reporting pieces, but I still don't really think of myself as a reporter, to be honest. I still think of myself more as a writer, and I know that's sort of an arbitrary distinction sometimes, but people obviously put different emphasis both in the time and approach, to writing. And some people are very much about the kind of fact gathering process and the interviews and things like that. And the writing is sort of like the last stage in some ways. For me, like, I'm thinking about the writing from the very first second I get an assignment, you know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about tone and texture and, you know, influences and things like that. Like, you know, some ways that kind of precedes the writing, actually, in some ways precedes everything else. I mean, and I'm thinking about the writing long before I'm actually doing any writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you have more of an artist's sensibility going into the information gathering, much like a novelist, only, you know, you're looking to make sure everything is verifiably true. But yeah. It's like you've got that, you don't necessarily have like the reporter like hat with the scoop, you know, you're not like a breaking news person, you know. But
right, exactly. Or investigative reporter or something like that, which is for better and worse, you know.
Right. Yeah. I'm sort of with you on that, Louisa, in that I feel like I'm a really shitty reporter. Like, if I had more strengths, it would be on, if I had to lean one way or the other, it would be more towards the writing versus the reporting. So there's always improvement on both scales, but especially the reporting. And I wonder, like, since you lean towards have more the writer's eye before the reporter's eye, like, what kind of growing pains did you experience as you were tried to hone your skills as an information gatherer?
I mean, I'm still experiencing growing pains. I probably always will be. Yeah. I'll be in the grave and still experiencing growing pains like this. A lot of reporters, like, they just can't wait to pick up the phone. I will do everything to avoid picking up the phone. That's the biggest one. I try to be a good listener. So I'd say is like a strength, but, I'm also sort of how do I put this? Sometimes people will say something to you and, you know, certain reporters will sort of be like, ah, that's gold. You know, they've exposed themselves in some way. And I'll hear that and be like, I'm not going to use that because they don't realize what they're saying. It's easy to take out of context or, yeah. So I think that's a big difference, actually. And it's probably held me back in terms of like writing clickable things, you know, things that people get buzzy about sometimes because I've chosen not to, you know, use a money quote or something. But at the same time, it feels like it's the only way I feel like I can do it with some kind of like, I'm not going to say integrity in terms of like character wise integrity, but I mean like taking the piece as a whole, you know, and wanting it not to get like yanked off its rails by something more kind of like exciting or, you know, easy to kind of grasp onto at the cost of everything else.
Yeah. I understand where you're coming from there. Cause especially if you spend a lot of time with somebody and other people, like their guard definitely drops. And so it's almost like, yeah, you almost want to, you do a little of that, policing of what they say for them, be like, you probably didn't really mean to say that. Cause
right. Well, exactly. And you know, it's a question. I mean, I think most reporters would say that's totally fair game. And I think ethically, technically it is, but at the same time, if you're trying to get at what they really are trying to say, you know, then the sort of bumbling way in which they do it the first time is maybe not, it's not only not fair to them, but in some ways it's not fair to the story.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in the minority on that front.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it depends. It depends on what type of stories you're going after, and where your taste lies. You know, if you're covering, you know, high politics,
right,
and people
course,
of power,
that's,
you know, that
totally, that's a very good point.
Yeah. That changes, it changes the rules a bit, but
right,
yeah.
If you're covering someone who's not like the most kind of articulate, you know, and has, and you're doing it, and it's a, like supposed to be a nice story, then mm-hmm. it's a different thing.
Yeah. And you said something earlier that I think was really interesting and important, in that like when it comes to wanting to pick up the phone, it's like there's a resistance to do that, that kind of that reporterly thing, or where, like you said, like some people, you know, they're itching to get on the phone and follow leads and chase leads and all that. How have you cultivated your own sense of getting a greater sense of comfort with doing that? You know, what are those hurdles, and how do you sort of get yourself primed to make those calls and to be a little, not aggressive, but like to push yourself to be into that uncomfortable position of, you know, having to make those calls?
If I'm being honest, I don't. I mean, not that I don't make them. I'm saying I don't get more comfortable.
Right.
You know, it's just something you have to do. It's just part of the job. You know, it's eating your broccoli. you know, I mean, in some cases, like, I guess the best way to become more comfortable, and this does happen, I'm really happy to say, with happens often enough that I keep doing it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would stop. But you know, you develop a relationship with the person, and you become comfortable with that specific person. It's more of like you are comfortable in the context of speaking with them, and you know, you might even enjoy that and learn a lot from them, rather than approaching it as something that you kind of have to do and dread doing. But I sort of have to relearn that every single story.
Mm-hmm. Do you experience like those sort of heart flutters and that anxiety when you have to make those calls and like?
Oh, totally.
Yeah,
absolutely. I also do a lot of historical writing. I mean, I've written two books that are, you know, not in the based in the 21st century. So, and I love chasing leads and, you know, digging up clues and things like that in that context. I love chasing down that kind of information. That is like the best part.
Right. It's not invasive or probing into like gnarly little corners, you know, like with the reporting and the research you did for Louisa, which which I'm almost through, which is just an awesome, awesome book. And I want to talk about that too. You're not dealing with like super sensitive, you know, like timely sensitive and stuff. You're dealing with a lot of dead people.
Yeah, exactly.
in archives. And then if you're talking to historians, it's like, well, you're kind of like picking their brain about their life's passion, which is kind of fun and not
exactly
icky.
Yeah. Yeah. And also when you come across something on the page, it's easier to kind of see in a larger constellation of comments and everything. Like if you have thousands of letters, you know, that's a lot more than a couple of hour long conversations or mm-hmm. 2 hour long conversation, you know?
Yeah.
Even if you're spending a lot of time with the person, like you can just get to know someone in a way, through the archives that you can't. And there's an irony to that because of course there's so many things you can't know, you know, if you can't meet them, and not only if you can't meet them, but if you can't live in their time, I mean, there's a whole different kind of worldview that you can know about, but you can't really break into, in any super meaningful sense. And yet, you know, you can get their voice in a really kind of compelling way.
And so you started with doing a lot of book reviews, and the books you've written are very historical in context.
Yeah.
So like there's those ways where you didn't necessarily have to talk to many living people in a sense.
Exactly.
That
yep.
makes you that makes you uncomfortable.
Not coincidentally.
Yeah. And so I wonder what was the need or the gravitation towards doing some journalism that does put you face to face with people where you do have to make that call. Like, why have you made that pivot?
I wouldn't say I've fully made the pivot in the sense that I still do a lot of the other kind of work. And even like I said, I even kind of approached even those stories and projects with more kind of a writerly bent than a repertorial one. But I did it because for all sorts of reasons. One is, you know, I was asked to do them and I thought it would be an interesting and good challenge. And so I said, yes, that's a lot where a lot of kind of work lies these days, frankly. I mean, I did it for practical reasons too, because you know, a girl's gotta make a living.
Right.
And you know, you can't eat book reviews, unfortunately.
Right. So being in such close orbit to David Remnick early on in your development there, what sort of influence and what did you learn from his work and maybe just being around him and watching him work? What were you able to maybe cherry pick and learn from him in your experience?
I've learned a ton. I mean, he's a phone picker upper. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, I learned that this is how it's done. This is not the way I do it. But I mean, I actually learned a lot about editing, to be honest, in some ways. And obviously that influences my writing hugely. But it definitely informed. I mean, I've also worked as an editor, and I would say that that experience was invaluable. You know, when I was working as an editor and also editing my own work. In some ways, I keep calling myself a writer, but in some ways, I'm actually just an editor. I just happen to edit my own work. So that was, I guess, that was the biggest thing I learned. I mean, the other thing, I guess, is, I mean, I learned a lot of the things about being a writer that you don't see on the outside. Like, I learned the difference between being a writer who's easy to deal with and being a writer who's difficult. Which I think a lot of people don't appreciate. Hmm. That was a lesson I learned early on, which has served me very well, I think.
So what does a difficult writer look like?
A difficult writer is someone who is very defensive and even contemptuous. I know that sounds kind of strong, but some writers are. They're sort of like, how dare you muck up my writing, and maybe you're not smart enough. I mean, none of it is like meant like that, but the defenses are so high when you're a writer because you're so vulnerable, you know?
Right.
And they're just people who are very kind of feel like what they did was right, and you're in the wrong for even suggesting that there might be a problem. What I learned is that an editor is often not right, actually. But they're not right in their solutions. They're usually right in locating the problems.
Okay. Yeah.
So basically, as a writer, the best thing to do is not to say like, oh, no, no, you don't get it. You know, this is perfect or whatever. The best thing to do is to sort of take an edit and say, okay, I don't like what the editor has done in this place. You know, I don't like their suggestion. But I recognize that there's a problem here that we need to address. And that has been really valuable. Mm. Because the editor in some ways is a proxy for the reader. It's your first reader. Right. You know, and if they have a problem, your reader is probably also going to have a problem.
They're very good. Like, say the suggestion, like the very granular suggestion might not be as agreeable. But the mere fact that something has to be suggested suggests a wrinkle is there that needs to be ironed out.
Yeah. I mean, and there are some writers who are kind of invasive for the point of being invasive. And, you know, you have to sort of learn what you're dealing with. But the point is, you have to take everything in good faith. And the whole process is just infinitely easier if you have open lines of communication with your editor and you're not a kind of knee-jerk reaction isn't to say like, no, I want it the way it is, and realize that it's a process. I mean, I think that the New Yorker is like it famously like, how do I put this? Invasive. You know, when you write a New Yorker story for the magazine, you have 5, 6, I don't know how many people are reading it, and they're all weighing in and they all have thoughts, and you have to learn how to sort of pick and choose what to listen to. But at the same time, there's no way to get through that process just by saying like, don't touch my copy. Hmm. And if you do that, you will not be writing there again.
I think there's a tendency too, if you're getting, when you're getting your stuff marked up, that it's hard to divorce like your own self-worth from the work.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what I was saying. Like, of course it's very fraught because, you know, every writer feels incredibly vulnerable. I mean, they wouldn't admit to that, but that's what's going on. You know, you feel like your heart is on the page, and every, you know, edit mark is like a dart in it.
You know? Yeah, because on the page, it can sound cold, and when you see it all marked up, and it's just like, it just sounds very sometimes robotic and be like, and mean sometimes. Yeah. But the fact is, like, say for yourself, if you're writing a piece for the New Yorker, and the mere fact that you're being edited means you have to accept that you're good. And now all these edits, they're not an indictment on you. It's making the work good. So like, you're good. They're just trying to make it better. And if you can like make that switch in your head.
And every place is different too, because the New Yorker has a certain kind of voice. I mean, this is historically more true than it is now, where it's sort of opening up a little bit, but the New Yorker is also interested in turning a story into a New Yorker story, mm-hmm. You know, which is not the same thing as a story for Vox, you know,
yeah,
or a story for, you know, Mother Jones, or a story for, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between publications, but part of what the process is, you know, recognizing that you're writing for a certain kind of publication with a certain kind of audience, and the editors are sort of giving it a kind of institutional polish or whatever. And some places don't do that. You know, there's some places that when you write, it, you are given much more autonomy. I mean, I wrote for and worked at Grantland for many years. Not many years, I should say, because it wasn't around for many years, but
yeah,
for many years, it, you know, felt like many years. And there is a place where it's very much more individualistic, and there's a kind of a cacophony or cornucopia of different kinds of voices and styles, and that kind of same sort of like consistency of voice and perspective and things like that is not only not kind of required, but not even like discouraged, you know? So I've seen it both ways and, you know, been part of that, both processes. But even then, you know, it makes such a difference to have writers who are really kind of see their others as collaborators and allies as opposed to like enemies.
Yeah, of course. I think the right approach, no matter what, is always thank you.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, if the editor is in...
That runs both ways. I mean, it's very important for the editor to say, like, thank you, and regard the writer as a collaborator and not as an antagonist.
Yeah, it's important. It's easy to see or interpret the relationship as being on opposite ends of the table, but maybe if both come at, you know, an editor who has done some writing and a writer who's done some editing can then come at it and say like, no, we're on the same side of the table. And with that mutual understanding can probably come, you know, the work is just only going to be that much better.
I mean, and it's true. I mean, when you're in a productive editor writer relationship, sometimes it can be fraught and frustrating, and your writer or your editor will drive you crazy. But at the same time, there's like nothing like that feeling where you feel like you have a piece that could only come so far, you know, by yourself has been carried forward, you know. And that's a kind of wonderful thing. You feel like something that couldn't have existed without this process now exists.
Yeah. It's a 1+1=3 type thing when it's humming.
Exactly. And I feel like those are some of the most rewarding, both from the editing and the writing side. Those are some of the most rewarding experiences I've had, you know, professionally.
So how do you, as someone who sort of gravitates, or maybe as your initial experience was more editing, when you start writing, how do you divorce the editor from the writer so you can actually free yourself to do the writing and then to put the editor hat on and not be like stymied or crippled by editor brain getting into the writing process?
I actually in some ways take the opposite approach, which is the idea that because I never really take off my editor hat, I take it off, but I don't divorce it. Like it goes on like a little bit of a vacation, you know? because the idea when I'm writing is that like whatever I'm putting onto the page is only rough copy. You know, there's no kind of attempt or false belief that this is going to be perfect and this is what's going to run and there's some sort of obligation to get it right on the first try. And that's really liberating because I know that there's going to be this process of revision and revision and revision. And therefore, as a writer, you know, that's totally freeing because you can try things and you can not get too kind of like hung up on yourself. If you know that what you're doing now is malleable and going to be changed anyway, so you might as well just get it done.
That takes a while to, for some people, that takes a while to cultivate that. There's a perfectionism that goes on in their head that things have to come out really good that first time. And if you can embrace that shitty first draft, which sounds like you can, then it really...
Although I have to qualify this by saying I have a lot of trouble getting started sometimes.
Okay.
How come? You know, like, because I do believe in the power of leads. Even if my lead is going to change, and it almost always does... I think that like you can really kind of set the course for a piece at the start. And also I'm a procrastinator. So, you know, I need the kind of heat of a deadline to sort of get the fire under my bum, you know, and get going. So it takes me a long, 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 long time sometimes to get stuff down on the page. And once I do, I'm not the sort of person who's kind of obsessively can't finish a paragraph because, you know, I can just write at that point. But it is often hard for me to get, you know, get that first paragraph on the page.
Yeah, there's a couple of good things to unpack there. With respect to the lead, I know I've heard John McPhee write about that. Like, he labors over the lead because he thinks it's like the flashlight that, like you were saying, kind of opens up the whole piece. It sets it up. I think Mary Carr, when she was writing The Liars Club, worked for like 9 months on the voice of that first chapter. And then that unlocked the rest of the book.
Yeah.
So,
I do have faith when I'm doing the lead. It's not like, oh, I'm never going to be able to write this. I'm never going to be able to write the lead, but I have a lot of confidence that once I figure that out, you know, there is like a kind of flashlight or key in that, you know, in there, so that once that is done, the rest will flow more easily.
How much, what does your process look like when you're trying to craft that lead? When you've got your notes and everything, are you charting mock outlines, index cards, cork boards? Like, how are you starting to manifest that lead for you?
It depends on what kind of piece I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So if I'm doing I'm working on a New Yorker piece right now, and I'm working on Evernote, you know, and I have lots of different files with different, you know, notes and kinds of notes, and they're tagged and whatever, to sort of keep myself a little bit organized, although it inevitably breaks down. When I wrote Louisa, I used Scrivener, another kind of writing software, and that was a much, 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 much more ambitious undertaking. So I had not only different like file cards, but it would often be too big for, like, I needed lots of different Scriveners. Mm-hmm. Like actual, you know, new, like, I don't even know what to call it. It's not a document, but I would say, but if I'm doing something like the piece that's in Best American Sports Writing, that's like I said, it's much more reactive. So that, like, I'll spend 2 hours just kind of trying to come up with my lead, and there's no real structure to that process. I'm just sort of like thinking, like, my only structure to that process is I'll usually go for a run or a walk. Mm-hmm. And like get away from the computer and just kind of like run through. I do a lot of writing in my head, so I'll just kind of try and write it in my head first. But I'm not outlining or anything. I'm like literally writing sentences in my head. And then when I come back, I can usually get started. But then there's no, I mean, that kind of piece, there's no time to do any real like cork boarding or whatever, you know. I mean, if it's a piece about a tennis match that happened that day, then time is of the essence, you know. And it's funny because like I'm both slow and fast. Like, I'm slow for internet writing. Like, you know, if I'm at the US Open or Wimbledon or something, and I'm in a room, you know, a massive media center, and a lot of those writers are getting their stuff up within an hour or two, you know, and I have no idea how they do that because I need, you know, I need 6 hours, 8 hours, you know, it seems impossible to do it in any less.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, compared to someone who's used to like the horizon of a magazine, you know, that's no time at all. So, but for a piece like that, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think of where I was when I wrote that. I was actually at a wedding.
Oh.
So it was a late afternoon wedding, so obviously it didn't interfere. But what I'm saying is, like, you know, I was in a hotel room, mm-hmm. just like trying to get it done because the day was full. And so you kind of have to just trust yourself in those moments.
Huh. And you also said that you're a procrastinator. And I wonder, what how does the nature of your procrastination manifest itself? And then how do you put it to bed and try to get to work?
How does it manifest itself?
Yeah, just, like what do you use? Like, you know, cat videos or TED Talks? Chess?
I play a lot of chess. Yeah. I used to read the entire internet. I've cured myself of that for better and worse. I've sort of like don't actually read a lot of internet-y stuff anymore. I read like the New York Times, and then if there's like a big, and I read the New Yorker, and if there's a big story or something that people are talking about, I'll read that. But I'm not a kind of obsessive Twitter feed hunter in the way that I used to be. And I don't have sites that I go to regularly anymore. I play a lot of chess, do a lot of chess tactics. That's like the biggest one. The other one is, you know, I cook a lot. I go for runs. That's have babies, so I'm sure that will disrupt all my thing, although give me much more kind of concrete deadlines. So yeah, so that's kind of how it manifests. And eventually you just kind of have to do it, and so you do it.
Of course. And how do you vet out your stories? And or what, you know, what draws you most and then allows you to like lean in with your full rigor?
Mostly, I mean, I like writing about tennis best. And because I do a lot of it, I feel like at this point I have a pretty good sense of what the big stories are and what's going on. So in some ways it comes pretty naturally. I mean, in something that's reactive, you don't vet it out. Like in that Wimbledon piece, you know, somebody won, somebody lost in both sides, men and women. And also, you know, there were some things I had in my mind. So that kind of like fed into the story. And it's pretty straightforward. There's no like pre-reporting or anything you have to do, except insofar as like you are following the tournament as a whole, you know, which I'm obviously doing. In tennis, it's like, it's a little bit more, I would say it's a little bit easier for me because, you know, I'm sort of alive to the various goings-ons, in the sport, without having to try too hard. You know, for other stories, sometimes I'm approached about them, and so they've sort of been pre-vetted. You know, an editor will have an idea, and then you start reading around and thinking, is this right for me? Is this a good story? You know, and it's like, what else has been written? It's the first question, usually. And if there's been a lot written, like, how can I basically carve out my own space? And if there's not been a lot written, you think, like, a combination of great and also like, why hasn't there been a lot written? Like, right. What am I missing? So you have to sort of balance those concerns. You know, I mean, I did deal with this in the book level too. I mean, I spent like 2 years at this point looking for my next book topic. And it's like every time sometimes spend months going down a certain road, you know, and reading a ton of things and getting really excited. And then you just kind of hit a wall and you realize you can't, there's no door in it. Mm. So you have to sort of turn back. So, I mean, this happens in every kind of writing. It's really hard to walk away from projects sometimes, and you have to be willing to do that. Obviously you can't always do that for different reasons. Either like you have an assignment and you just need to do it. I mean, another thing that like, I think a lot of writers are sort of precious about their writing. You know, they really consider it like a vocation, you know, and everything they write has to be like special. I sort of take a view that like some things you write have to be special, but also this, if it's your job, which it is for me, then sometimes you also just have to write things. You have to do the best you can and turn it in and turn the page.
Right. That's a good point. There are some things that you want to really lean into with like your full like artistic sensibility. And and then there are some things that are, you know, like, you know what? I got to bang out this slideshow in 2 hours and it is what it is. It's not what I'm necessarily proud of and not what I'd maybe put on my clips on my website, but it's something that gets me a little money and that allows you to do the other things. So you make up money so you can make your art.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what is some of that sort of nuts and bolts writing that, you know, this, for lack of a better term, like you're not super advertising it. You're not really say proud of it.
Oh, yeah, no, I definitely do that.
Yeah, yeah. What does some of that work look like for you?
Oh, now, see, now you're trying to tell me to advertise it.
Okay.
I'm trying to keep it hidden.
Well, personally, like, I did a lot of, like, slideshows and stuff for Bleacher Report for a long time. They took a lot of time, and it was definitely not something that I was sharing, but it was something, winners and losers from fill in the blank NASCAR race.
Right.
It's like, it's its own thing. I didn't have to commute anywhere.
Right. But... exactly. I call it mercenary writing.
Nice. That's so perfect.
I do, I try and make sure that's not the, that's not how I'm spending all my time for sure. But I think that, there aren't very many writers who can get away with doing no mercenary writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that you're just, because a lot of people don't want to admit it. They almost want, like, the stuff that is that gets anthologized. You want to believe that, like, that's the only gig in town. And for a very small few, like, you're Don Minatas and Bright Thompsons and Michael Lewis and folks of that ilk who have, like, a salaried gig at some, big magazine.
Sure, like, if you're on staff at Vanity Fair, like, good for you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they can, every single piece they do can be artful. But yes, the mercenary stuff, I think it's really important that you are, have the courage to even talk about it. Because I think a lot of people there might be a little embarrassment involved, right?
Sure, of course. Naturally.
See, there it is. It's perfect. So aside from, picking up the phone is something that is hard. I have the same anxiety. I'll sweat, my palms will sweat when I have to pick up the phone, especially for a cold call, and you got to sell yourself a bit. But what else do you find that you struggle with but you're able to get over it so you can get the work done?
Let's see. I think we've actually covered many things besides picking up the phone, getting started, pacing myself.
Leads.
Those are big ones. Leads. Kickers. We'll throw that in there. How do you kind of really nail the ending?
The hammer.
Being disciplined, I would say, about being disciplined in general, because I don't have an office to go to. And so it's very easy for me to spend my day working, not working,
Yeah. Cleaning the house. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
Those are things, one always will struggle with. Yeah. I think those are kind of a big one. And then also how to be alive to your different, for lack of a better word, constituents.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you writing this for? Who are you writing it? Are you writing it for yourself? Are you writing it for what kind of audience are you trying to reach? What is your responsibility to the story? What is your responsibility to the subject? Figuring out that kind of stuff. What's your responsibility to the agreement you made, in terms of timing and practical stuff? Those are all things you sort of have to negotiate every time you do a story.
I'm sorry. Go on. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you work solely at home for the most part?
Yeah, or at coffee shops.
Mm-hmm. What does hard work look like to you? How do you measure it so you feel like at the end of the day, you're like, oh, yeah, I got the most out of it. That was a good day of work. You can get after it the next day. So sometimes in this line of work, it's a little hard to measure. And I wonder how you measure it so you feel satisfied.
I measure it in all different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Doing the kind of writing I do, sometimes, like, a lot of the, blog posts I do are done in a single day.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that will be a day of work, And at the end of the day, you can say, okay, I did that, good job, or bad job, or whatever, usual job. But, I'm not thinking, like, it's kind of self-contained in a way that other kinds of writing aren't. Like, if I'm working on the book, it you know, sometimes it'll be like I made a certain kind of breakthrough, you know, that I was kind of stuck on something and I figured it out. And sometimes that will look like only a couple lines on the page, you know, but it was like a tremendous amount of like mental and energy and work. And sometimes, you know, a successful day is having written 3,000 words or, you know, I don't really kind of put a, I have done writing projects where I just need to like do a certain amount of, it actually is pretty measured where I'm like, I'm going to write 1,000 words a day. And there's a kind of discipline to that. But I am also kind of generally pretty flexible about what constitutes good day, bad day. And I've also had days where I've like produced a lot and not felt great about it. So, you know, I wouldn't be able to describe it very easily.
Mm-hmm. And how do you go about organizing your notes and the a lot of the research you do, especially for something that's as labor intensive as your biography on Louisa Adams? So, yeah, how do you go about organizing stuff? And then, yeah.
Well, for that, I mean, I mentioned this, I use this program Scrivener.
Yep. Yep.
So I would have, you know, a Scrivener dedicated to, her papers. I actually had, I think, 4 dedicated to her papers because there were so many, you know, and once the size gets too big, you have to start a new one. And then, you know, is one dedicated to Adam's family papers and one dedicated to other people's papers, you know, that are relevant. And then I had a timeline, I guess the biggest, and then I had like one dedicated to kind of thematic stuff. So like I had notes on like, you know, her notes on women, you know, that was one, or like money, mm-hmm. You know, geography, kind of big picture stuff where I would sort of like throw information. So sometimes when I was adding notes, I would be adding them to multiple note cards, multiple documents.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a kind of massive timeline, which was sort of like the spine of the book because I ended up going pretty chronologically. And the timeline was just culled from everything. And it included like snippets of quotes that I might want to use and, you know, just facts and information and the timeline. And then I would have often like notes, you know, under the timeline about things that I wanted to focus on and, you know, even sentences I wanted to, that had in my mind that I didn't want to forget, you know, or phrases or things like that. And that kind of became that was as close to I got as like actually outlining that book.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, it was massive.
Yeah.
Every year had its own card.
Huh.
You know, so I ended up with, you know, more than 70 of them, like documents.
Wow.
So yeah, it was a huge and kind of sprawling research process. And then of course I switched computers and like the thing didn't transfer properly and, you know, it was a mess. So, but you know, it all worked out in the end.
And when you're conducting interviews, do you use a recorder? And
I do. Yeah.
You do. And do you do your own transcriptions?
When I'm doing phone stuff, I sometimes do, but, I mean, I have one of these apps where you can record a phone conversation,
mm-hmm.
but often I'm just transcribing as I go on the phone, but, cause I can type faster than I can write. I'm a really bad, one of my biggest weaknesses, I would say, mm-hmm. this is not a small thing. I have really bad handwriting.
Yeah. Me too.
And I'm slow when I'm handwriting. So like, I basically cannot keep up with a conversation or read it afterward. So I try and record interviews and then like use my handwriting disasters for taking notes about, you know, context.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a night or an evening routine that sets up your mornings, or do you try to get up early and set things up in the morning itself to try to set up your day to win?
Morning. I'm not really a morning person, so I actually use the morning to sort of get myself organized. I'm not like a wake up at six and start writing. Mm-hmm. I'm more of a like, you're more likely to see me writing at, you know, 1:30 a.m. than you are to see me writing at 7:30 a.m.
Wow. Yeah. And so what time do you end up waking up?
What time do I, it depends. My fiance is a graduate student, so he has very variable hours as well. Mm-hmm. So we end up getting like, it depends. It'll sometimes be 11 and it'll sometimes be 2, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, very variable. And I end up getting, that's when I go to bed, and I end up getting up at anywhere between 7 and 9.
Yeah.
But even when I, like, I'll get up at 7, but I'm not, you know, I make breakfast, I read the newspaper, I, you know, I kind of don't really kind of, unless I have something to do, like, imminently.
Right.
Again, deadlines are helpful. I am a little bit kind of, like, lackadaisical through my morning, and then I can sort of bear down later on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I work at night a lot.
Okay. And have you had any, I don't know, maybe what you would call a favorite failure that has helped sort of coach you into your current success, something you learned?
I wish I could say they were my favorites. I definitely have had some less successful memories. I've learned a lot from them, but...
Do you have any specific one that comes to mind?
I'm trying to think. I don't know. I mean, I definitely have had pieces that I wish I'd done differently, or massive things I wish I'd done differently. but they're usually pretty kind of like, I don't usually draw macro lessons from them. I think more about this is what I would have done differently in this specific instance.
So maybe in the last 5 years or so, is there any behavior or habit that you would say has improved, you know, the work you do or even your life that helps set up your work to be more successful and you feel more satisfied with it?
I would say that, I mean, something I learned later on, I wouldn't say this is the last 5 years. I would say last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe last 5 years. Revising is huge for me. I'm really kind of embracing that as opposed to sort of pretending that's not true. Writing away from the computer, which I already mentioned, like writing in my head, kind of trying to have a certain kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I'm big into like feeling your way in stories, which is a kind of vague thing to say, but, I feel like there's often like a kind of like a unwritten story beneath the surface story, you know, and you sort of have to kind of like get intimate with it.
Mm. How do you get there?
You don't get there in front of the computer. You don't get there outlining in my experience. I don't, you know, I get there by like just letting my thoughts like run and think, you know, and going on walks and not being too kind of pushing it too hard, but, you know, giving yourself the kind of time and space, even if the time and space is like, even if you're doing something that day, you know, with this piece, for instance, letting yourself sort of like take an hour or two and just think about it, without sort of trying to like rush the words onto the page.
And are you listening when you go on these walks? Are you unplugged or do you listen to?
Yeah, no. I mean, sometimes I can listen to like, there's certain kinds of music you can listen to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, actually, sometimes like I'll, if there's like a tone, there's a tone I know I want to write, like in, I will find like a movie soundtrack that will have the kind of same tone. But yeah, definitely no like proper music or podcasts or anything like that because. You have to be able to hear yourself.
Right. And what kind of other artistic media do you like to consume that helps to inform your reading and your writing, whether that's podcasts or documentary film or feature films?
I mean, I like movies, but I wouldn't say that that is, I wouldn't, I'm not a big watcher of things. And I listen to podcasts, but again, I don't think it's really informing me. Novels, frankly, poetry. I mean, that kind of feeds into my writing for sure. There's some stories that I will come back to kind of again and again, just for craft reasons.
Yeah, when I was reading, as I'm reading Louisa, it struck me like it was very influenced, at least just from me, maybe this is completely false, but very like Jane Austen, like really seemed to come through for me anyway. I think it had a very a Pride and Prejudice feel to it, especially in the early goings. And I went,
yeah, no, I mean, actually had, that, I'm glad you said that because I had a different book in mind for each section, or not a different book, but a different writer. And for the first section, it was Jane Austen for sure.
Yeah, I caught one line too. It was like the, you know, a man with a fortune.
Yeah,
I was like, overt. There it is.
It was a little tell. Yeah, so I had, you know, that was Jane Austen. There was a Middlemarch section. There was a War and Peace section. I wouldn't say that there were inspirations. They were more kind of just like quietly informing. They were a little bit like fertilizer in the soil.
Yeah, and or a coach, right?
Yeah. You know? I mean, Jane Austen was also really interesting. I went back and read all of her books because, you know, Jane Austen and Louisa were born in the same year.
Oh, wow.
In England. And in the same sort of economic stratum. So it was actually, but it was incredibly helpful for me to go back and read her books because in this time, instead of reading them as like the romantic novels that I read them, you know, as in high school, I read them as like products of their time and place and, you know, written in the climate in which they were written about, in, about which I now knew a lot. And I realized that there were like so much about money and which I just hadn't seen, you know, everybody has like a price tag, you know, like so-and-so is like worth, you know, £500 or, you know, marriages are alliances and contracts really. And everything is like a diplomatic negotiation. I mean, there's this, just this way in which the kind of economic and contractual reality of marriage is just like so much a part of the story that I just didn't appreciate before. And that really helped me understand some of the things that Louisa went through, which I didn't really make sense to me before then. Not because they explained anything like specific, but just they helped give me a sort of sense of what it was like to live and be at that time.
Yeah. And what are, you know, you mentioned Jane Austen, of course. What are some books or that you find yourself maybe rereading that help remind you of like, oh yeah, that's how it's done. And it, those are like we were just saying, like the coaches that help you along. What are some of those titles you revisit?
I mean, when I'm doing like biography and history, I would say there are a couple of writers like Richard Holmes is someone I'll read a few pages of just to get him in my, you know, get him in my ear. I will read, and it depends on what I'm doing, you know, because often I want something specific, but, or there are a couple of books that, you know, like Stacey Schiff's Vera was really important to me when I was writing Louisa. You know, I mean, there are things like that. There's some essays like Gay Talese's Silent Season of a Hero is something I read, you know, 20 times. It depends on what I'm doing, but yeah, I mean, I have a Evernote document with just like articles that don't even necessarily mean a lot to me, or I don't think they're not always great articles, but they just have some great sentences in them, and I like hearing those. And Larissa McFarquhar is a writer that I read, you know, kind of not only for pleasure, but for kind of, you know, try and sort of draw her blood a little bit.
Can you recall a book or two that sort of turned the world from black and white into color? Like kind of unlock things like, oh, like I can do that.
I don't know if they were like so much like I can do that, but like, wow, writing can do that.
That's what I mean. Because with our diminished writers' self-confidence, they're like, there's no way in hell I could do that.
Yeah. I would say that Shelley by Richard Holmes, who I just mentioned, was one of those books where I was like, oh my God, a book can have energy, you know, in this way. Like a book can run.
A book can run. That's great.
I mean, I think that the kind of, I mean, I'm going to mention writers I just mentioned because they're front of my mind, but, you know, in very different ways, both Larissa McFarquhar and Gaetulies do interiority in a way that I really both admire and aspire to, you know, where you feel like you're kind of getting inside of a character, but without the sort of like, transgressive violence to their actual being. You know, those are reading some of them. I was like, wow, this is what I want to do.
Nice. And how have you managed or not managed, but I suspect managed to kind of run your own race? Because it's easy to compare yourself to people you admire and to people you aspire to be. And sometimes you can get into traps of comparison. So
partly what's helped me is like writing about sports, actually. Because not many people write about sports the way I try to do it. Probably more do now than did when I started 5 years ago. So that was one way, you know, just clearing my own like little subject lane. Or feeling like I did. I don't think I actually did, but feeling like I did. Yeah. And then, you know, kind of trusting that what you're doing is also just not being, I guess, what's a better way to put this? Having a more generous view to say, like, many good things can exist.
Right.
You know, not to be like, oh, only there's only one good story about this or one, you know. But the idea that there's a lot of room in the world for good writing.
It's like the rising tide.
Yeah, exactly. Theory,
right? Yeah, it's not zero sum.
Yeah.
You know, what are you working on these days and what still excites you to the point where you're...
I'm going to be a little bit quiet about actually my current projects.
All right.
That's okay.
Well, oh, yeah, of course. So what... in any case, like what do you find still excites you about the process that keeps bringing you back to the ledger and to keep digging into the stories that you find artful and truly love?
I just still like words mostly. I like sentences. I still kind of get off on a great sentence. That's what does it. That's as simple as that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're always after, like, you know, borrow a term from baseball, like that perfect contact
where you almost
don't even feel it hit the bat.
Yeah.
Very nice. Louisa, I want to be mindful of your time. This has been wonderful. I've been just tickled to, you know, hear you speak about your wonderful work and everything. Where can people find you online and get more familiar with your work if they're not already tuned in?
Sure. I have a website, which I need to update, but louisathomas.com, where you can find my writing and a little bit more about Louisa and Conscience, Louisa being my latest book. I write for the New Yorker's website, so that's newyorker.com. And I also write a little bit for the magazine, but not that much. But and then I have, probably for like the writing I do elsewhere, it's easiest to find on the writings tab of my website.
Very nice. Very nice.
And I'll use that as a spur to update it.
Another round in the can. What you get from it? Any takeaways? What are you struggling with in your own work? Feel free to reach out via email or Twitter. I'm easy enough to find. I also have a monthly newsletter where I send out my book recommendations and what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. Head over to brendanomera.com to subscribe. There you'll also find show notes to all the episodes of the podcast. Newsletters once a month, no spam, you can't beat it. I think I reached a new low. I begged my wife to subscribe to the podcast, but I stopped short of bribing her. You know what she said?
You know, a girl's gotta make a living.
Right. Until next time, have a CNF and good week.